Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Charity Funds podcast. We are now back for season two, where we'll be focusing on all things well-being. We wanted to mix things up a little bit this season, so we'll be having a guest host take over each episode, and they'll be inviting three guests who will be interviewed about various topics surrounding well-being.
To kick things off, I want to introduce our very first guest host, who is not only one of our beloved trustees, but she's also a digital communication consultant, regular columnist in the third sector, where she writes about all things digital and was named one of the 100 most influential people in the charity sector. On top of all of that, she authored the Charity Comms Wellbeing Guide for comms professionals. So without further ado, we welcome Kirsty Marins.
Thank you so much, Lauren. I'm delighted to be here.
We're really, really, really happy to have you. I'm sure everyone can hear that you wear many hats, but we'd love to hear a little bit more about you and your journey and writing and authoring the guide and why you're so passionate about wellbeing.
Sure. Well, I've worked in digital comms since 2007. And over those years, I've had lots of experiences of dealing with really difficult and emotional content, as well as sometimes, you know, horrible comments and trolling on social media. Some charities have processes in place to help staff who are exposed to this emotive content, and some simply don't. So the Wellbeing Guide came about after I saw a number of charities dealing with sustained crises on social media, and it made me really question what support there was for those staff having to deal with it. And I thought, you know, as a sector, we don't really talk about this aspect of our work enough. And there also, at the time, wasn't really many free resources or guidance that was aimed specifically at charity comms professionals. So hence the guide was born.
Wow, amazing. It sounds like its own pandemic of its own. And I just kind of wanted to touch upon that. It's extremely timely, especially as so many people are experiencing burnout and Zoom fatigue. And I wanted to ask your opinion on how the nature of modern work as a result of the pandemic poses a threat to mental health.
I think it's important to really acknowledge, though, that burnout happened way before COVID and the pandemic, in our sector especially, but definitely it's been exacerbated over the last year. And I mean, there are so many factors contributing to that, which we cover in this episode with the guests that I talk to. I think one good thing to come out of the pandemic is that it's made a lot of organizations more conscious about their staff's mental health and well-being, and that they're actually starting to take it more seriously too.
I'm glad you talked about staff being more aware of it now, because I'm a big fan of your charity club on Clubhouse. It's a great group of people that meet every Tuesday and talk about various topics. But I was fortunate enough to tune into the wellbeing panel, and your speakers touched upon some great points. Eleanor from WWF and Ben from Asthma UK, talking about resilience and wellbeing training and people struggling to strike the right balance between work and home life. So I wondered if you could share some tips about how people can create better boundaries for themselves to ensure they're able to cope.
Sure. I mean, to be honest, our guests cover this brilliantly. So I think I'm just going to share one tip, and that's rethink your meetings. So as you mentioned, we've all got Zoom fatigue. And I think what people maybe don't realize is that video meetings are particularly draining because of the constant eye contact. Think about when you're in a meeting face to face, it's not, you know, always necessary to be looking at the person talking. You know, you could be writing notes, you could be looking out of the, you know, window briefly, looking around the table at your other colleagues. So I think, you know, we need to ask ourselves, is a video meeting really necessary? Or could maybe just a good old fashioned telephone call do instead? And if you do a, you know, telephone call, that way you could actually make it a walking meeting. So, you know, you give people the opportunity to go outside and get some fresh air. And actually, whilst we're on the subject of meetings, please, please, please ban them over lunchtime. You know, my guest, Robin, he says that they have done this at Impetus. They have banned at lunchtime meetings to give staff the opportunity to go outside and also to have a well-deserved lunch break. So I think that would be my absolute top tip.
Do you know, it's so funny. I even think sometimes oh my gosh, I'm looking at myself so much, which is something I wouldn't do. It's so weird, and I'm so conscious, and I'm trying to listen as well. So it's definitely think that's something to think about for various reasons. But
you do know that you can turn yourself off though. There is an option. Yes. To turn off your videos, you don't see yourself. So I recommend that as well.
In my next meeting, I'm going to do that for sure, because I need to stop looking at myself. Lastly, you touched upon Robin's top tip about meetings, etc. And I want to wrap this up because this is not my interview. Kirsty is taking over. And I know everybody's excited to hear about these insights. But what else can we expect from this episode?
So if you're wondering how your charity can improve staff well-being and support staff with their mental health, then you're going to hear some inspiring ways that you can do that in this episode. And the good news is, it doesn't matter what your budget is, any charity can improve on this area. When speaking to my guests, the common theme was that there needs to be an open culture around mental health and well-being, and that this will only be achieved with the leadership team who drives it from the top down.
Oh my gosh, I'm very, very, very excited to listen to the full version of this podcast. So that's it from me and Kirsty, and I'm going to hand it over to Kirsty to introduce her first guest.
I'm absolutely delighted today to have as my guest Kirsty Campbell. Kirsty is a senior fundraising manager with nearly 10 years' experience of working across corporate and community fundraising. She is currently the senior regional relationship manager at Blood Cancer UK and leads a team of 7 regional fundraisers to support and grow their network of regional supporters and community groups. So welcome, Kirsty, to the podcast on wellbeing.
Thanks, Kirsty. That was quite a flattering introduction, and thanks very much for having me along to speak with you today.
Absolute pleasure. So my first question for you, Kirsty, is do you feel that working from home and not being able to see your colleagues in person has had a negative effect on your well-being?
That's a really interesting question, and the fact that I've worked from home for 8 years now, so I've become quite used to remote working. I would say if anything, the pandemic has helped level the playing field in terms of managing my well-being, as now everyone who works from home is experiencing the same working environment. So for example, all communications are tailored for remote workers and all meetings are virtual, so remote colleagues dialing in or attending virtually aren't considered an afterthought. I also used to travel quite regularly to London and across the UK, and always in a bid to get the cheapest flights to minimise the costs for whatever charity I was working for. This would usually involve getting the earliest or latest possible flight home. So and I think what the pandemic has actually highlighted to me is how detrimental that approach was to my ability to manage my well-being. So I hope that some elements of virtual working will continue post-pandemic.
I've heard that from a few charity staff who work remotely, who have always worked remotely. They say the same thing, that actually they feel like the pandemic has helped them feel more like part of the team, because as you say, there's that like level playing field now, everybody's in the same situation. And I think it's interesting because on the flip side, it has probably given those colleagues who do go into the office every day that sort of, I guess, understanding and almost empathy in a way for, you know, colleagues who do work from home. So I think it has had some benefits, and hopefully some of those will stay.
Absolutely, I would hope so. And I think it will be quite an interesting transition as we emerge into a kind of post-pandemic working environment. There will be a further adjustment that we'll need to make across the sector in terms of managing a blended approach of office working and virtual working. From experience, it seems to be quite easy to manage meetings or manage communications when either everyone is based in an office or when everybody's based remotely. Where it can get difficult is when you're trying to take a blended approach, and I think considering that and making plans for that is going to be really important for the third sector and I suppose any working environment just now.
Yeah, absolutely, 100%. So I did a call out on Twitter to find examples of charities that were doing amazing things in terms of helping staff with their well-being. And you were one of the people that replied and said about all the wonderful things that Blood Cancer UK are doing. And I thought it was really interesting because you described yourself as a former stoical well-being skeptic. And you said that now you feel fully supported to manage both your own and your team's well-being. So I'm just wondering how you've sort of moved from that skeptic to now an advocate.
I think it's important to say that I still believe in stoicism in the true philosophical sense of the word. So when you experience challenges or setbacks, trying to compare that against a wider perspective, looking at the bigger picture, and also understanding that there's elements that you will never be able to control. But I think over the last few years, what I've recognised is that you can only really take that balanced approach when you have a good, solid grounding in terms of your well-being.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose what changed my perspective slightly was a period of burnout back in 2017. I was working in a high-profile partnership at that time. It was quite a fast-paced, dynamic working environment, and there was a number of setbacks and major issues and curveballs that came my way in quite short succession. And these individually, these were all things that I would quite happily manage and take ownership of and deal with. But I quickly recognised that my ability to take things in my stride was largely dependent on how many things I was trying to take in my stride.
Sure.
And I find it helpful to picture well-being as reserves that can be drained by things that take up your energy, so those challenges and setbacks, but can be replenished by doing things that benefit you, whether that be things outside of work in terms of engaging with friends and family, doing things that you enjoy, or things inside of work. And I find that if that balance is off and your reserves drain faster than you can top them up, then you have less capacity to manage any challenges coming your way.
Yeah.
And I think the pandemic has taken a lot out of all of our reserves, some more than others, but it's undoubtedly impacted all of us in one way or another. And ultimately that means that our resilience in facing whatever work and life throws at us is ultimately reduced overall.
Absolutely. And you know, I think it's an interesting view of sort of well-being, and I think it's one that we always have to remember. Well-being is both upon us ourselves to manage our own well-being, but equally our organization needs to support us as well and recognize when staff are feeling sort of close to burnout. So I just wondered, Blood Cancer UK, you shared with me that they have a whole host of mental health and well-being sort of tools. I think you've got a couple of strategies. Do you just want to quickly talk us through how they are supporting staff well-being?
It was identified as a priority by Blood Cancer UK pre-pandemic. So in 2019, we put in some groundwork in order to manage employees' well-being and ensure that staff and managers were empowered with the tool. And we've also adopted some practices that are common in a healthcare setting. So we've introduced external supervisions for our support line team, which allow them to reflect on any challenging conversations that they've had with supporters. And we've also introduced Schwartz rounds, where people can come and share experiences relating to a specific strong framework topic in place. It meant we could quite quickly start considering the additional tools and resources which would be helpful for employees to manage their well-being. We've also got a really strong leadership team and a really strong HR team who prioritise staff well-being, and we launched a staff well-being strategy in April 2020, which has a number of different strands. So under the mental health strands, we have a number of tools, including an employee assistant program, which is an external source of support. We have our mental health first aiders, which is an internal source of support, and to help get a little bit more insight from other members across the organization.
I'm so impressed that your leadership team takes mental health and well-being so seriously. And I think, you know, it is so important that staff see that from the top down. And obviously Blood Cancer UK, you know, recognized this and took action before the pandemic even started. But I wonder, do you feel that maybe the pandemic has forced the sector into acknowledging that well-being is actually an issue?
Yes, absolutely. And I think in two ways. The first way is particularly relevant for regional or community fundraisers and the struggles that come along with working from home. Pre-pandemic, I used to hear a lot of comments around, oh, it must be nice to sit in your jammies all day and watch Jeremy Kyle. But I think as we've all moved to home working, people have realised that that's absolutely not the reality of working from home day to day. But there is a recognition now that there are some major challenges in terms of achieving a work-life balance when working from home that need to be addressed. I also hope that many managers will now understand why asking a national team of fundraisers to come together on a regular basis, maybe once a month, is now maybe not the best use of everybody's time. And it's not necessary. We can have productive meetings virtually. And I really hope that we can take forward the benefits of pandemic working and post-pandemic environment that we emerge into. The second way I think the pandemic has forced the sector into acknowledging that wellbeing is an issue for us is that supporters are becoming more willing to share their own wellbeing struggles as the conversation around mental health kind of grows across our society. And I think it's important to recognise the impact on staff wellbeing as a result of that. So, for example, at Blood Cancer UK, we've launched a new virtual walking event called Walk of Light, and we've had over 2,000 participants sign up to that event, which is absolutely fantastic. Many of those are new supporters to Blood Cancer UK, and as a result, my team are prioritising welcome calls to those supporters. And because they're new supporters, they are sharing their connection to us as a cause and their reason for supporting and taking part. And as a result, these are leading to what can be sometimes quite emotional calls, as many supporters are taking part in memory of someone who they've lost to blood cancer or following colleague, friend or family member's diagnosis. And I actually had a discussion with my team in terms of how we can manage the knock-on impact of that on my team. And we put some kind of practical plan in place in terms of making sure that we are recognising that taking some time out after a difficult call is part and parcel of our roles, and ensuring that everybody across the team knows that they can reach out to each other informally for a little bit of support or access our mental health first aiders or our employee assistance programme after those calls to provide a little bit of additional support. And we're also looking to book in some formal reflection sessions similar to the supervision sessions that are run for our support services team. I think it's important for charities to recognise that we are often managing highly emotive conversations with supporters, we're managing highly emotive causes day in, day out, and I think we need to recognise as a sector that we need to make sure that that safeguarding is in place, especially for frontline workers and staff that are having those conversations with either supporters or beneficiaries.
100%. And that's actually one of the reasons why I co-authored the Wellbeing Guide for Comms Professionals for Charity Comms. You know, we kind of internalize it, and it can be really hard-hitting stuff. And you know, on the flip side, you've got, you know, potentially you might be dealing with like trolls on social media. Yeah. Or all of that sort of thing. And, you know, for people who work remotely anyway, like your regional fundraisers or, you know, regional PRs, you know, that's something that is really, really key to address. And that's obviously been highlighted now even more with people working from home, that sort of need to be able to maybe have a debrief after with someone in your team to just say, had this chat, it's made me feel, you know, X, Y, Z. I just need to talk about it. I just need a bit of support. It's so important. And so I'm really glad that you addressed that. And you've sort of segued brilliantly onto my last question. So you've mentioned, you know, that kind of work-life balance. And with everybody now working from home and those who have never had to work from home before, I wondered if you had any sort of practical tips or how people can ensure that they separate that work and that home life.
Absolutely. First thing that I would say before I give any advice is that this is the kind of ideal working scenario. It's not necessarily the reality, but I think just having certain approaches in the back of your mind when you are feeling slightly run down or feeling the impact of working from home, tapping into any of these resources or approaches. So the first thing that I would like to stress is do not access your work email or Teams or any other communication channels on your personal phone. I'll be honest, this is only something that I've adopted in the last 12 months, but it really has made a significant difference. It means that I'm not interrupted outside of work, and also not ruminating over any conversations or replies or any email chains that have gone on that day. I used to find myself sometimes in a really bad cycle, sitting on the couch at 10 o'clock at night, and once I'd checked Instagram, once I'd checked Facebook, once I'd checked the news, I would then go back on and check my emails that day. You know, oh, I should have worded that email a little bit better, and what exactly did that person mean?
Yes.
So I've removed that from my personal phone, and the difference has been remarkable. Also getting outside at least once a day. Again, it took me years to actually put this into practice, and my husband's actually quite good at nagging me to go for a walk, and it pains me to say it, but he's right. It does, even 15-20 minutes, it just takes the edge off it, and just having that break from the screen means that you're
just having some headspace.
If you can, I would say having a designated space for working, and actually taking the time not just to close your laptop, but to physically power it down, shut your laptop down, and put it out of sight at the end of the day. It just stops that temptation to log back on just to finish that one last thing. And then also during the day, I would try to avoid back-to-back meetings. I would say broadcasting on Zoom/Teams takes much more energy than having a telephone conversation or providing an update in person. And I think it's important to recognise that you need to ring fence time to be able to have the headspace to go on with your day job, not just be presenting or updating meetings.
Absolutely. And also not everything has to be a video call.
Exactly. Exactly.
Meetings is a big issue in the sector. There are too many meetings, like you say, to the point of when do you actually action any of the things you're meant to have actioned from the meetings. So I'm really hoping that, you know, we have sort of less meetings going forward. And I 100% agree with all of your tips. I think they're brilliant. I think that you're a senior leader yourself. It is also about practicing what you preach. You know, if you're telling your team, switch off at 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock or whatever it is, don't be answering emails at 10 o'clock, but then you're firing one off at 10 o'clock at night, it then sort of gives them that, like, oh my goodness, am I meant to be checking my emails at 10 o'clock at night? Am I meant to be, you know, replying to this? So I think sort of setting those boundaries, but then also practicing what you preach and making sure that senior leaders are not kind of going against the advice that they're giving.
Yeah, absolutely. The importance of modeling that behavior has become really clear. And I hope my team would agree that that's something that they're seeing more. And also there's things that you can do, even if you do choose to work late. We've got agile principles in place in work, which means that we can, if we want to take a morning off and work in the evening because that suits us better that day, then we can.
Yes.
But I think it's also recognising that even if you're sending emails at 8, 9, 10 o'clock at night, that might make you feel good because you've got that off your to-do list. However, the impact of that is someone logging in the next morning to a long list of emails.
Yes.
So I think it's also recognizing and respecting other people's boundaries and thinking about it in that way.
Yeah, that's such a good point. It is interesting, like you said, I think flexibility is sort of a big keyword now. And you know, I get your point. You know, in the past, if you were traveling and, you know, you're standing in the queue and it's 8 p.m. and you might as well send off an email, like, what's the harm? I guess it's just more, you know, the person that is the recipient of that email, knowing that that's why you're doing it and that there's no need to action it, or that they don't need to be logging in to check if you've sent an email at 8 p.m.
Yeah, absolutely. Setting those boundaries for yourself in terms of what works for your well-being. Yes. And also respecting other people's boundaries that they are set to maintain their well-being is so important.
Absolutely. Kirsty, thank you so much for your time. It's been absolutely brilliant to talk to you and to find out how Blood Cancer UK is really taking such a good approach to mental health and well-being and yourself with you and your team. And thank you so much for sharing all your practical tips. So my next guest has worked within Charity Comms for 7 years. They are currently the communications manager at Impetus, which is a charity that transforms the lives of young people from disadvantaged backgrounds by ensuring that they get the right support to succeed in school, in work, and in life. And if that's not busy enough, Robin is also a comms lead for the Youth Employment Group, which brings together key leaders and experts around the youth employment sector to help drive the UK's response to the COVID-19 crisis. So a huge welcome to Robin Lanphier.
Thanks, Kirsty. Pleased to be here.
So, Robin, could you talk us through why you feel Impetus is a shining example of an organisation who takes mental health and well-being so seriously?
Sure. So I think before getting into that, I would say that we wouldn't consider ourselves to be a shining example just yet. We think we've done some great work on this, and we're certainly getting there, but we want to acknowledge we're not experts in this, mm-hmm. and there's always room to improve. I would say we've always had a very good and supportive culture at Impetus, celebrating achievements, multiculturalism, an employee assistance program. But our journey here within mental health and well-being has been about formalizing what we already had and going further, born of a greater desire to foster the right internal culture. There's been a melting pot of issues in recent months and years from mental health and Black Lives Matter. And I think whilst there's been a number of tragic events within that, the upside is it's driven awareness and action amongst some conscientious organisations that really want to do well by their people. And at Impetus, it's kicked off a number of projects, task forces, audits, and wellbeing is just one of those. But yeah, in terms of what we're doing now, which I'm sort of really proud of us for, is I think there's real kindness and authenticity from our leadership team. They express genuine care for the team through communications. And what's great is they follow through on those communications with really well-considered and considerate gestures. In recent months, we've had from our CEO a Christmas parcel, a Valentine's parcel, which was hilarious because it sort of kicked off a couple of very inquisitive looks from, I think, significant others. And also an enforced wellbeing hour from 1 till 2 every day, where we're told not to make any internal meetings, or we're encouraged not to have any external meetings. And that's all about, it's the months where it's dark and you start work, it's dark when you finish work. There's no time to really or address your well-being whilst it's still sunny. So we're encouraged to do that during 1 till 2. And I think that's a lovely gesture.
Yeah, absolutely agree. I love that.
The next point would be, outside of our leadership team, we've been encouraging communication across all levels of the organisation. So we've done a lot of work on making it okay to be honest about how we feel. We start our team catch-ups with a check-in on our well-being. Colleagues have been incredibly good at modelling being open and honest with each other when they're struggling, and giving advice on the right places to find support and what they found useful during their struggles. And I think all of that combined has really fostered more openness and honesty, building on what we had before. Then the last thing is putting in some real concrete guidance and training in place to make sure we're doing and we're confident we're doing the right things. So we've had a series of mental health awareness training and we've put in place mental health first aiders. We've put in place a mental health and wellbeing task force. So to build on the strategy we have in place, there's a team that really focuses on tactical activity. So how do we drive awareness of the offering we have? And we've weaved all of this within our internal comms activities. So within our weekly update, our weekly internal comms email, there's a constant wellbeing section, which is always populated. There's always room for a wellbeing section within the agenda on our all staff meetings as well.
So you said, I wouldn't say we're a shining example because there's always work to do and there's always things to improve, but I have to disagree with you. I mean, Impetus is a huge shining example of taking it so seriously. And I mean, what you've described, I think, is phenomenal. And I hope, you know, charities that are listening to this podcast will learn a lot from that and, you know, take some of the things that you're doing and implement them themselves. I'm so impressed to hear also that you have a mental health strategy and a task force. Did Yes. this exist though prior to the pandemic, or has it been developed as a result of, like, you know, people having to work from home and remotely and just, you know, general anxiety around the pandemic?
Yeah, it did start before. It was born of those things I spoke about before in terms of
Yes.
right by our people. But I think the work we had to do was about quickly adapting to encompass working from home, which in terms of what we've done well to meet this huge challenge, I think it's being adaptive in our offering. The plan before lockdown was to be really consistent in everything from a health and wellbeing point of view, both in our values and our offering, which made perfect sense at the time, because if you are really consistent and you can keep reading what you have and have confidence that staff know what they need to know, where they need to find support, that kind of stuff. I think what we've learned as a result of lockdown is that it's really important to be consistent in your values, but be adaptable in your offering.
Mm-hmm.
People's experience of working from home alone has sort of swung wildly. A typical example would be people struggled very early on. Then as they adapted, they started to enjoy it a little bit. And now people might be exhausted. And then you fold all the other stuff into the mix, like any dependables you might have with you, having to do homeschooling. And so to have a static offering for mental health and well-being at a time when people's experiences change so drastically, it doesn't make sense. So we've remained flexible in terms of working hours, but we've brought in things like we have what we call RCTs, which is a terrible pun on randomized controlled trials, which is a part of our work, but they are randomized coffee times. Terrible pun. But it's a half an hour slot that you have a random colleague every week, and it's a time where you can talk to them about something other than work, which is, it's really important if it's something that's really missing from working from the office. And it's quite awkward to do, but you can't just wander over to someone's desk, or you can't just call them because it feels oddly intrusive. We've had after work virtual drinks on and off, a book club, a yoga club, one-to-one catch-ups, and we've maintained that sort of culture of honest and open feedback. So I think we've weaved those in and out when they felt appropriate. That hour every day when we have time to go out in the sun, that's obviously something new for the winter months. So we've changed up our offering.
I love that. Those are all such good examples. And also what I'm so impressed about is it's one thing to have, you know, a sort of mental health strategy, and it's another thing to actually live and breathe it. And I'm really encouraged to hear that your senior leadership team is really driving it and that they're really invested, because I think that's so important.
Absolutely. I think it's really important to know that there's somebody within the organization's leadership that cares about you.
So do you think, you know, obviously you've been doing work in this area within the organisation prior to the pandemic, but there are lots of charities who perhaps haven't really thought about well-being that much. Do you think that maybe the pandemic has forced the sector as a whole into acknowledging that well-being is actually an issue?
I think so. I think at Impetus, we fund a number of charity partners, and we work in coalition with a lot of other charities. So we have quite a good sense of what other charities think. I think it's definitely the case that the pandemic has forced a number of charities into acknowledging this. It's a really tricky time. I think if you consider the sort of typical perceptions of the third sector versus the private sector, the perception that the third sector is easier or more welcoming, or the hours are shorter. And I think that was never the case in the first place. And then you fold in lockdown, where beneficiaries for a lot of organisations now need more support than they needed beforehand. And at the same time, charities' capacity and resources down. So I think charities and charity workers are having to work a lot harder. And I think there's a natural sort of capacity for people to want to do that work, because people working within charities have such passion for the cause that their organization exists to address. So yeah, whilst at the same time charity workers are potentially working harder, it's much harder to keep an eye out on people. You can't see how long someone is staying in the office for. You can't see if they physically look stressed. So I think it's just a huge challenge. And I mean, yeah, I think charities are starting to realise that. As I say, a number of charities we speak to are starting to realise that. And yeah, fingers crossed, more charities start to take notice and start to do some work on this, because otherwise it could become a really big problem.
Absolutely. I think we as a sector are really good at probably looking out for sort of the well-being of our beneficiaries or our service users or our volunteers or our supporters. But perhaps we don't always, you know, do that internally. And equally, I think we're really good as a sector at speaking out about mental health. So, you know, most charities will probably get involved in like Mental Health Awareness Week or Time to Talk Day. But do you think that we should maybe be doing more to speak publicly about mental health in the sector? And if so, how do you think we should do that?
Good question. I mean, in many ways, this isn't just a sector thing. I mean, the country and other sectors as a whole need to get better. But yes, I do think the third sector needs to get better at this. And it's always struck me as quite odd, really, because a lot of third sector organisations, to your point, are very good at talking about difficult and nuanced issues. But in terms of their beneficiaries, and that they struggle a little bit talking about the issues that they have internally and the issues that their employees have. I would say that from the conversations I've had and from what I've seen, it's not due to a lack of desire or passion from organisations to talk about this issue. I think it's a mix of priorities and a little bit of fear, really. I think from a priorities point of view, I mean, a lot of charities' resource and capacity are always very low. And it's as, in order to talk about the issues that our employees are facing, we have to in some way drop something that our beneficiaries are experiencing. And so I think in order for the sector to talk more about that, they need to address the priorities thing. And from a fear point of view, there are a number of things at play there. I think from our point of view, we're a funder as well as a charity. And our big thing is about talking from a place of data. Anything we do, from our policy research to investing in charities, we make sure it's data driven. So there's always this desire to get our ducks in a row before we talk about anything. And then for other charity organizations, it might be that they simply just don't want to get it wrong. Especially for charities where they feel like we have our issue and mental health isn't our issue, and so we're not comfortable talking about it. I think my response to all of that really would be, one, a very basic point that as well as having a responsibility to beneficiaries, you are an employer. You have a responsibility to employees, and it's important that your staff know that you take that responsibility seriously. But also I'd liken it to some of the things we've seen within Black Lives Matter and, you know, the tragic sort of recent Sarah Everard case and some of the stuff we've seen on Twitter about not all men, in that how important it is to be an ally with certain movements. You need to be talking out if you want to be a part of positive change. It's not good. I don't think it's good enough, frankly, anymore to just be silent on mental health. I think by staying silent, you're potentially damaging that movement.
Wow. I mean, so many great points there, Robin. I almost feel like we could, you know, chat for hours. And I think it is interesting, that whole point you made around lots of charities, whether you're really big or really small, are always stretched in terms of time and resource. So sometimes things like a mental health strategy is just not a priority, because as you said, it means having to then drop something else. But I feel like it should be a priority, because it's sort of happy, well-supported staff that are encouraged to be open and honest and have that really open culture just seem to thrive, and they're more productive. There's just so many positive reasons around it. So thank you for sharing that.
You're welcome.
So the last question I have for you is, you know, obviously we've all been for the last year working and living in the same environment, and it can be really difficult to switch off after work and to kind of have those different aspects of our lives as separate. So do you have any practical tips that you could share?
So to my point earlier, it's important to find a time during the day where consistently you get your lunch break, and ideally you find some time to get out of the house, get out in the sunlight. If you can agree that with your manager, with your employees, a time during the day where all of you agree you won't have meetings, I think that's been incredibly beneficial for us and has made the day feel less like a constant slog. I think it's when we were back in the office, people were working more standardized hours. I think it's been great that we've moved to flexible hours and people are able to make their home life work for them. But what that has meant is there's less standardized lunch times, less standardized times when people start and finish. So it's difficult to have that time of the day when nobody's having meetings. I think by having that, yeah, it's been a time where we can get out of the house, see your house as less of a solid 8 hours of work every day. There's sort of very, very, very basic stuff about having work mobile phones. If you can encourage your employee to do that, it's a difficult sort of initial step of having to carry this extra black box around with you. But really great to stop having work WhatsApps and team messages. And my extra tip, I guess, would be about finding a way of not having that section of your house or your flat that only exists for work. The thing I did is we had a little budget for a desk and a chair, and I made sure that my desk and chair were foldable so I can move it around the house, and that stops me from having to think this is the section of the house that means work. And then it also means at the end of the day I can fold away my desk and my chair and that signals this is me finishing work. And I think it depends on people's personal experience of the company they're in at the moment. But I think it can be very difficult if you're working 8 hours a day and you're not finding any time for social activity whatsoever. I think in office spaces, people would naturally get to know the people that they work with. That can be very difficult working from home because, as I said, it's less natural to give someone a Teams call, give someone a Zoom call than it is to wander over to their desk. So if you can work that into your diaries, working time for you to get to know a colleague, your team a little bit better, that doesn't have to be so focused on work, I think that can make your workday a little less heavy.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm currently doing an interim role at Media Trust and we had a weekly social that everybody attends and we're not allowed to talk about work, which I think is really nice. But we've also had some new staff joining during the pandemic and it's always a great way for them to then be kind of introduced. That then makes it easier to kind of, you know, reach out and say, oh, well, let's have a cup of virtual coffee in the next week or so. I think you're right. It's so difficult now when we're not in that physical environment where, you know, you'd walk over to make yourself a cup of tea and there'd be somebody that you don't recognize and you're like, oh, hi. Those kind of spontaneous conversations.
Sure.
Robin, it has been an absolute pleasure to talk to you today. Thank you so much. I feel like I've learned loads talking to you and I really hope everyone who's listening has taken down loads of notes or, you know, maybe are going to share this podcast with their senior leaders or if they are a senior leader, I hope they're going to implement some of the great work that you're doing at Impetus in terms of well-being and mental health because I think it's brilliant.
Thanks, Kirsty. And if anyone wants to reach out to me, reach out. I'll be happy to answer any questions anyone has.
I am thrilled to introduce my next guest, Lara Burns, who has worked in the charity sector for the last 10 years, but has been working in digital throughout her career. Just 18 months ago, she joined the Scouts as Chief Digital Officer, where she leads the digital transformation of a 100-year-old charity, working with over 150,000 volunteers across the UK who deliver skills for life to around 400,000 young people. As well as her digital work, Lara has also been working with other senior leaders in the charity to help focus on the well-being of staff during the pandemic. So welcome, Lara, to the podcast. We are delighted to have you.
Hi, nice to be here.
So Lara, as a leader of the Scouts, how important is it that well-being and mental health is really embedded in the culture of the charity? And how would you say that you're doing this?
I think it's absolutely essential and definitely something that we have taken seriously always, but particularly as a result of the pandemic and really understanding the impact that it's had on staff. How are we doing it? Well, I think, first of all, we're talking about it. And I would say that's probably the most important thing. Right from the start of the pandemic, our CEO, Matt, and other leaders have always talked about how much we are thinking about our staff's mental health and well-being. And I think we're pretty open as leaders about our own mental health and well-being, and obviously kind of trying to model the fact that it's actually okay to talk about whether you're feeling bad or how you're finding things. So that's really important. And that was part of our initial tactics, was really about encouraging people to talk about it at senior levels, talking about how people were finding things in their own teams. We provided lots of resources with links to other places, like, you know, the information that Samaritans have, like Mind have. And those are things that are really important that we provided to people.
Amazing. It's really interesting. I think there's a common theme with all of the guests that I've spoken to. And that is, I think in order for sort of well-being and mental health to work within their charity, it really has to come from the top down. And also there has to be an open culture around talking about mental health. So I'm really pleased to hear that. And I think you told me on Twitter about, and I've seen your tweets actually, about hashtag your time. So could you talk us through what that is?
Yeah, I mean, it's actually something that we've done relatively recently. I'm part of a group of kind of senior managers that we actually call it business operations, which sounds really boring. And some of it has been really about fairly logistical things that we've had to deal with through the pandemic. But a lot of the stuff that we talk about is really about well-being and how we can support staff. And you know, we've been through some really tough times. We had up to 50% of our staff on furlough kind of over the summer. We've had to make quite a significant amount of redundancies, unfortunately, last year. And also the staff that are left now, the left around now, you know, those people have been working really hard. Lots of people have been working really long hours. They've been turning their, you know, their minds to doing things that aren't probably typical part of their normal job. So we think it's really important that we kind of give back a little bit to people, you know, and as we're in the charity sector, we can't give people extra pay rises always. We can't, you know, necessarily do things from a financial point of view. But what we thought is, well, let's give some people some time back. And so your time is 2 hours a week on a Tuesday and a Thursday, 1 hour on Tuesday, 1 hour on Thursday, where we block it out of people's diaries. So that's done globally across the company and it's blocked out. So people can't put meetings in. And the intention is that we're giving people back time, your time, mm-hmm. to do what they want. So some people are choosing to take that time and, you know, I guess while parents were at home with their kids, whether that's spending a bit of time with their kids, it's whether they want to go and walk their dog, go and do some exercise, just sit and read the paper, whatever it is. But we've also put some stuff on that we've organised centrally. So for instance, I do a yoga class once a week during that time that's organised through Teams from the company. Or there's also been some mindfulness classes. We have a quiz. We have a book club. So again, it's kind of trying to give people back some time out of the day in order to make sure that they're looking after themselves, taking a bit of time away from the kind of non-stop work that I think a lot of us have found fairly relentless over the last year.
Yeah, no, I love that idea. And actually, Robin, one of the other guests that we're speaking to on the podcast, at their charity, they've decided every day to block out lunchtime just so that there are never meetings scheduled over lunchtime so that people get the opportunity to go outside, you know, if they're not able to go out before work or after work or over the winter. Obviously, yeah. It was dark when you woke up and it was dark at, you know, 3:30 p.m. So I love that idea of, you know, making it sort of mandatory just to give people time to spend, as you say, in any way that they choose.
Yeah, and I think it's a trust thing. We know that most people have been working way longer hours than they're contracted to do, but even that they normally do. You know, people work into the evening because I guess there's not much else to do for some of us, you know. It's kind of recognizing that and recognizing mm-hmm. that, yeah, we need to give people some time back really and make sure that they're okay.
Absolutely. And I think it's interesting because you touched on, you know, that 50% of your staff had to go on furlough and that you've also had to unfortunately make redundancies. And I know that you're, you know, certainly not the only charity. But I think it's also important to acknowledge that burnout has also happened, you know, prior to the pandemic. I think our sector is made up of people who are passionate about making the world a better place. You know, sometimes we work with limited resources and budgets, which means people work longer hours or, you know, even over weekends. But I feel like the pandemic has probably exacerbated that. So, yeah. You know, for those organizations who maybe didn't do anything in terms of staff well-being prior to the pandemic, do you think that this has maybe been a bit of a wake-up call for them?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think, like you said, it is fairly common in the sector. And I actually really hope that those organisations who maybe didn't take it quite so seriously or who didn't really focus on it have now really focused on it and they've seen it sort of pushed up the agenda a bit more now. I think, again, you know, when we compare ourselves with the commercial sector, you know, commercial sector tend to give people, I don't know, extra health support packages or whatever else it is that we can't necessarily afford to do. But, you know, like we've just talked about with your time, we can give people time back and we can give them a bit more flexibility some ways. And I think there are other things that we can do, you know, and we work in a sector where ultimately we hear about caring for other people and caring for the community that we live in. And if we can't do that for our staff, I think that's a bit sad really. So I really do hope it is a massive wake-up call for those organizations that haven't prioritized it, and I hope it's a wake-up call for staff who go, well, actually if that organisation doesn't prioritise this, then I'm going to go somewhere else, because there are lots of organisations that have really, really looked after their staff through this pandemic. And I think they're the ones that people will look back and go, yeah, those are the kind of people that I want to work for.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more. And I think it's interesting because there are charities big and small. There's so many things that they could be doing in terms of, you know, well-being and mental health. Some of them, unfortunately, cost money. You know, so as you say, giving staff, you know, access potentially to like counsellors, putting staff on mental health first aider courses, that sort of thing. I guess, do you have any tips for charities who maybe don't have those sorts of resources to pay for that sort of support or to send staff on training? You know, what could they be doing with limited budgets to improve staff wellbeing?
Well, I think both of them are linked to giving people time. So there are a lot of free resources out there. You don't have to pay for courses. There's a lot of stuff, you know, even Samaritans have got some really great basic stuff, you know, some basic videos to help people understand how they could support colleagues with mental health issues, or how to sort of get people to just talk. And that stuff's all there for free. So anyone that says, oh, I have to pay for training, I don't have much sympathy for. You know, it's just that would be about giving people a bit of time during the day to go, okay, go and watch a video, go and do a bit more learning, go and do a bit more reading, you know, come and share what you found. I don't think that's that complicated. And again, this is about being human, right? It you know, I don't think that's something that's exclusive to anyone that happens to have gone on a mental health wellbeing course. I think we can all learn how to be a bit more human and be supportive to colleagues. I do think the time thing is the important thing. The examples that we've talked about here of giving people maybe an extra hour at lunch, you know, we had some extra days off that we were given, again, globally last year, where we had two extra days, one in the summer and one near Christmas, that we gave across the organisation. I do think there's something there about, obviously, as much as you can, giving everyone it at the same time. So it means that no one's on email. So it's all very well saying, well, you take an hour and then I'll take an hour. You know, one of you comes back and then there's a whole load of emails or a whole load of tasks. Whereas if we're all taking it at the same time, we're not generating more work for each other. I do think there's something really valuable about that. And that was why we all took a day off in the summer at the same time, because we knew that it meant, you know, we weren't going to come back to a whole load of stuff that someone else had generated for us. So I think there's just something there about giving people time, whether that's a little bit of time, because, you know, you're a really small charity and you can only give someone an extra hour on a Friday, but whether it's sometimes giving people a day, I think people really, really appreciate it.
Absolutely. I know at CharityComms, you know, in my role as trustee, we gave staff time off at Christmas. Also, staff are taking time off altogether in August. And it's exactly for the reasons that you said, you know, it has benefits if everybody is taking time off at the same time. You know, and of course, I don't mean 2 weeks, but, you know, a few days here and there, because as you say, it just means that when you do come back, you don't have, you know, 400 emails that suddenly need answering or loads of work to do because everybody's been off.
Yeah, and I think it also, it's that sort of ethos of we're all in this together, you know, which obviously Absolutely. Is really something that's come through this pandemic and kind of, you know, really built those feelings of community. I think people joining together to help each other and how do you generate that feeling is actually as important as anything.
Definitely. So lastly, what would you say has been the one thing that's really helped you personally in terms of your well-being and your mental health during this down period?
Well, I've turned into a walker.
Are you a rambler now?
I am not quite a rambler, but I walk every day. I usually try and go for a walk before work. I found it really important to get out of the house, again, no matter what the weather. I don't have a dog, so sometimes people look at me crazily like, why are you walking in this weather? You don't even have a dog that's making you go out. I find even if it's 10 minutes, sometimes I go for longer, you know, sometimes I walk and talk to someone on the phone, sometimes I listen to a podcast, sometimes I listen to the music, sometimes I sort of march because I'm frustrated, sometimes I amble, sometimes I cry, to be honest, you know, sometimes I really have been overwhelmed and it kind of helps. But for me, just getting out, having some space away from the house, away from the screen. I tend to look at the sky, and I'm lucky because I don't live in the middle of the city, but looking at the sky and having that sense of something bigger and looking outside of myself really, really makes a difference. Even if I've had a really rubbish day, it somehow sort of helps ground me. And it does, it has really helped me look after my mental health, absolutely.
Exactly the same as you. I go out for a walk in the morning before starting work because I feel like it sets you up for the day as well. It's a little bit like going on a commute, even though you're not, you know, it's sort of just giving you that physical space to step outside. You know, you've just woken up and then the next thing you sit down and you start working. So I feel it's been really helpful for me as well to, you know, just a kind of break to, you know, get dressed, walk around the block. I like to get a takeout coffee. So almost replicating that kind of commute. I also do the same as you, listen to a podcast or make a telephone call. And yeah, it's definitely helped me as well. I think it just clears my mind before I sit down at my desk and have to start work.
And it kind of reminds you who you are somehow, I think, you know, what I'm going to work for, you know, why am I doing this? What's my purpose? What am I going to get through today? You know, sometimes those are big thoughts, sometimes they're quite specific thoughts, and it just helps you to focus. And I think, you know, it's that classic thing, isn't it, of somehow walking, putting one foot in front of the other, just helps you move onwards and move forwards.
I love that analogy. That's brilliant. Lara, it has been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you for your expertise. Thank you for your honesty. It's been brilliant. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast to chat with us about wellbeing.
Wow, what an amazing first episode. And thank you to our guest host, Kirsty, who you can find on Twitter at LondonKirsty. Also, a massive thank you to Kirsty, Robin and Lara for some great takeaways. As Kirsty mentioned, she authored our wellbeing guide for comms professionals. And I wanted to stress that wellbeing is a responsibility that we all have. And this guide is for everyone, whether you're a sole communicator or you work in a team of 20. Every article in there is written to help anyone at any stage of their career and with every organisation in mind. It's also a living guide, meaning that it can be added to over time. If you're a charity leading the way when it comes to staff wellbeing or you're a mental health professional, get in touch and share your tips. So that's it for the first episode. Keep an eye out on our socials for the next guest host. Till then, if there's anything that you want to hear about or you have any questions for us, then I'm Lauren Hazel on Twitter, or you can head over to the Charity Comms Twitter page at charitycomms. Alternatively, you can reach out to me at my Charity Comms email, which is in the episode description. Make sure you subscribe, and if you'd like to be notified when we upload, and if you enjoyed the episode, we'd really appreciate a review or rating. See you soon. Bye for now.